I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the department to the 36th Malinowski Memorial Lecture, which, as most of you will know, is held not only to honor the memory of our illustrious ancestor, but also to mark the achievements of a rising star in our discipline. And this year we're extremely fortunate to have Dr. Barbara Bodenhorn give the lecture. Dr. Bodenhorn has interrupted a period of teaching and research in Alaska to be with us this evening. Dr. Bodenhorn was a late convert to anthropology. She originally graduated with distinction from the University of Michigan in German literature and political science in the late 1960s, and it was not until more than 10 years later that she came originally to Cambridge to study anthropology, having in the interim been, amongst other things, a director of social services in an Inuit community in Alaska. She's currently an affiliated lecturer in the Cambridge Department of Anthropology and a college lecturer at Pembroke and Girton Colleges. Dr. Bodenhorn stuck for her ethnographic research with Inuit communities in Alaska, and her work is renowned for her sensitive and meticulous fieldwork and for her concern with its accountability to the people that she studies. Its thematic focus has been on the interconnections between kinship, economics, and symbolic systems, on gender relations, environmentalism, and the politics of anthropology, and on the way in which the data from Arctic communities fits into, or very often doesn't fit into, general models of hunter-gatherer societies. Her subtle and sophisticated analyses of Inuit ideologies of kinship, sharing, and exchange are widely regarded as major contributions to the general anthropological literature. Dr. Bodenhorn's lecture this evening has the intriguing title, If Malinowski Met Boas in Barrow, Looking Across the Boundaries of Fieldwork from the 1890s to the 1990s. Dr. Bodenhorn.
I didn't realize all of that was known. Clearly, given the title of this lecture series and the fact that I've come from Barrow, Alaska, where I'm currently working in order to give it, because it felt to me when I was invited that I couldn't say, well, I'm busy that year, you know. I need to be talking about the fieldwork process itself. I want to look at not only some of the origin stories considering the centrality of fieldwork to anthropology as a discipline, but also some of the myths that continue to surround the question of its importance to whatever or whoever it is that anthropologists do and are. The title itself grew out of a casual conversation that I had with a friend and colleague working on some of Boas's papers whilst at the Smithsonian Institution. Namely, if there is any way that we could know what these two big men thought of each other. Malinowski makes favorable but passing remarks about Boas's historical point of view in, for instance, A Scientific Theory of Culture. I came across no references to Malinowski in any of Boas's later works, for instance, his 1945 posthumous article on recent anthropology. They did, of course, meet, but at Columbia University rather than on the tundra surrounding Barrow, and that's a point to which I'll return. Now, in many ways, it's become canonical to characterize fieldwork as a rite of passage, a conversion experience, an initiation. The authenticating experience allowing one into the cohort that is the Academy of Anthropologists. Central to that is the need for the authenticating myths, the Malinowskian myth of the centrality of fieldwork acting precisely in a Malinowskian way as a charter to build up the feeling of belonging. The Malinowskian myth of Malinowski's invention of fieldwork, bringing weight to his and others' assertions of its importance. The myth is a powerful one. I've been intrigued by the regularity with which my students in Cambridge regularly talk about Malinowski's invention of fieldwork, putting a stop to all that nasty armchair speculation. Now, personally, for me, one of the most useful resources for the North Slope region, as I was beginning my book research, was John Murdoch's report to the Smithsonian Institution, the ethnological results of the Point Barrow expedition, which was conducted between 1881 and 1883, the year before Malinowski's birth. Organized as a collaborative effort between the U.S. Signal Corps and the Smithsonian Institution, this was, as Fitzhugh points out, the first integrated, multidisciplinary scientific study ever produced on an Arctic location. Certainly, it was the first in North America. Now, this expedition was only one of several in the Arctic to be sponsored by the Smithsonian in the last decades of the 19th century. Edward Nelson spent 4 years, from 1877 to 1881, traveling through the Bering Strait with a Yupik, a Southwest Inuit companion. He took a year to begin in order to learn the language before he started to travel. Fitzhugh again, I'm sorry, I've lost my place, as Boas as well, sponsored not by the Bureau, but by the German newspaper Der Berliner Tageblatt, carried on the German tradition of the 1870s and 1880s, spent 1883 to 1884 traveling through Baffinland, resulting in his first monograph, The Central Eskimo, later sold to the Bureau of American Ethnology, and precipitating his shift from geography to anthropology. Now, none of these men were trained anthropologists. Murdoch was a zoologist, Nelson an ornithologist, and Boas a physicist working as a geographer. By the same token, however, none assumed that the ethnological aspect of their research was in any way secondary. Indeed, Boas would say, besides the mere geographical work that I did, I also made ethnographical collections and observations. Now, until the 1920s, it's possible that continental Europeans may have considered this, in Stocking's words, as mere collection. And in fact, collection itself was actually very, very important, whereas the real work of interpretation and theorizing would be done by the professionals in their chairs. The findings were produced, however, by the researchers themselves as volumes of ethnographical results that stood and continue to stand on their own merits. Now, I am not going to launch into a description of how Boas got there first. Neither Boas nor Malinowski invented fieldwork as a method of obtaining information, but both must be credited with defining intensive fieldwork as the central method for anthropologists in their respective countries of adoption. I'm not interested in establishing the winner of this process, but at looking at some of the interchanges between Boas and British anthropologists from the late 19th century when his ethnological work began and the early 1940s when both Boas and Malinowski died. British and American anthropology did indeed develop separate trajectories during much of this century, but not because British and American anthropologists failed to talk to each other. They talked to each other a great deal. It is perhaps somewhat perplexing that given anthropology's current interest in process and permeable boundaries, that the stories told to our students, and certainly the stories that students reproduce back to us, continue to lead them to think that schools of thought somehow developed in splendid geographical isolation. I also want to think about the more contemporary myth, the mythic narrative, that of fieldwork as an initiating rite of passage. This is a powerful image as well. As a graduate student at Cambridge, I was well aware that my status as a post-fieldwork student, as opposed to a pre-fieldwork student, was marked in many ways, and that post was better. Now, of course, it's important to realize that neither fieldwork nor its ethnographic outcome can be taken as transparent processes, and that the processes themselves take on complex layers of meaning. Of course, we have to be aware that the tactical use of been there, done that, is needed or is used to establish an authoritative voice. Boaz is no exception, as we see in the conclusion of the quote that I started above. I made observations which give many new points of view referring to the religious ideas and traditions of the Eskimo. As I learned the language of this people, I was able to understand the old songs and tales. As I lived amongst them, as one of them, I learned their habits and ways. We can sympathize with Stocking's plaintive observation that his own lack of fieldwork rendered his career at Chicago somewhat problematic in terms of his colleagues' acceptance of him as a real anthropologist. But the potential for an uncritical acceptance of this stance to lead to an entirely anthropologist-centric view of the process as an individual experience is great, and I think dangerous to the discipline as a whole. Now, this is not something that is a new observation, I know. Malinowski may have considered himself, akin to Conrad, embarked on a voyage during which he could in some way create the people he was working with, as he suggests in his diary. The Trobrianders, I suspect, had other ideas of what was going on. Fieldwork is not something that an individual does. It is a social context involving numbers of actors. To think about fieldwork as a process, we must consider, as far as possible, the reactions and expectations of all participants. I thus wish to consider alternatives to the ways we pass on these two specific myths, each based on a kind of exclusion. The first excludes the lively networks of communication that crossed national, institutional, and disciplinary boundaries in the first decades of this century. The second excludes the people with whom anthropologists work. All storytelling, all model building is by definition selective and therefore exclusive in some sense. That we need stories to help define who and what we are has been the subject of some discussion, for instance, by Hart and Grimshaw, Jorion and Schaffer. What and how we select these stories needs to be part of a conscious and ongoing process. These particular narratives, I shall argue, cloud ways in which we might usefully approach the problems of fieldwork in the 1990s, because of the particular ways they exclude significant others, and that's written with a small o. So I want to start with some of the interconnections, Boaz and the British social anthropologists. And I realize that this is actually quite, I'm making a lot of presumptions here because I'm doing a historical account from Barrow. I couldn't have done it 10 years ago. There were no libraries there. There is a library now, and you can get interlibrary loans, and you have friends who can send you things by fax, and it was very helpful. In what follows, I want to trace some of the development of Boaz's thinking about what could and could not be learned through fieldwork. More importantly for this paper, I want also to highlight some of the interactions that took place as part of that process at three moments in his career. With Tyler at the start when Boaz was thinking through his positions on method, with Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown at the height of his career when race was a highly fundable research area, and with Malinowski himself in the decade before their deaths when the freedom to undertake research was under considerable pressure. As I said earlier, Boaz's initial field experience in Baffinland came at the time as a large effort on the part of the Bureau of American Ethnology to document the geographical, physical, and social conditions of the indigenous peoples of North America. These efforts had not gone unnoticed in the United Kingdom, and by 1884, Tyler helped to establish a committee of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, quote, for the purposes of investigating and publishing reports on the physical characteristics, languages, and industrial and social conditions of the Northwestern tribes of the Dominion of Canada. By 1887, Boaz had already begun his theoretical challenge to a number of assumptions underlying the evolutionist models of the time. In a series of articles published in Science, Boaz attacked what he saw to be one of the major flawed assumptions of the evolutionist school, namely that like causes have like effects. He turned this on his head, stating unequivocally that unlike causes produce like effects. This forms the basis of his major quarrel with the evolutionists and their aims, with which he was at sympathy for several decades at least. Their deductionist methods, he felt, simply did not have the information necessary to produce a hypothesis of the magnitude of social evolutionism. And because of this hypothesis, they were categorizing artifacts and information according to unsubstantiated criteria. Instead, Boaz insisted, specifics must be understood in situ before generalizing laws could be contemplated. His conviction that the problem of meaning was at the heart of anthropological inquiry meant, he argued, that things and ideas need to be understood in their context. This included present usage as well as historical trajectories. The key to understanding the relationship between elements and wholes was the problem. Each element needs to be seen according to its surrounds, which includes the history of the people, the influences of the region through which it has passed in its migration, and the people with whom it's come into contact, plural. Now, this stance, particularistic and holistic, although including an emphasis on the importance of specific history in a way that the British functionalists would not, was even now undermined by the conviction, underpinned by the conviction that culture, rather than either biology or environment, was the major influence on the nature of social life, which in turn supported a relativist position. This is all in 1887. It is my opinion that the main object of ethnological collections should be the dissemination of the fact that civilization is not something absolute, and that it is relative, and that our ideas and conceptions are true only so far as our civilization goes. Boaz's work came to Tyler's attention through publication of his ethnological results, primarily in Science, and he was hired by the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1887 to act as their agent in the Canadian Northwest, marking, as Stocking notes, a shift away from the use of travelers and missionaries to the employment of trained natural scientists. This he would do for the next 10 years, leaving for Victoria around the same time as Haddon's departure for the Torres Straits. During this period, Boaz's letters to Tyler indicate an ongoing exchange of ideas between the two men, in which Tyler presents his use of statistics as a method for mapping the developments of social evolution, for instance, whereas Boaz enthusiastically embraces their possibilities for documenting diffusion. One sees as well the statement of issues in these same letters, which would become further accepted cornerstones of the fieldwork method, namely extended stays. A long residence among each tribe is almost indispensable. A knowledge of the language and an opportunity to observe as well as to get informant reports. For a satisfactory study of this difficult subject, shamanism, it would be necessary to learn the Kwakiutl language and then to visit that region in December and January. It is necessary not only to ask and to hear, but to see and observe. A look at the index of Boaz's professional papers indicates that Tyler wrote to Boaz regularly throughout the former's tenure with the association, 25 letters between 1888 and 1898. Haddon and Boaz as well apparently enjoyed a lively postal relationship, exchanging letters between 1902 and 1935. 18 from Haddon and 14 from Boaz. As of this writing, I know nothing of the communications between Boaz and Rivers, who had accompanied Haddon on the Torres Straits expedition, and who in the first years of the 20th century would champion concrete work in the field for British-trained social anthropologists. Schaffer details the remarkable parallel developments between the two physicists-turned-anthropologists, but he does it as precisely that. It would be interesting to know if they were in direct communication. They certainly read and published in the same journals. Boaz's full critique of the methods used with the assumptions of evolutionism, the limitations of the comparative method of anthropology, was published in 1896, creating considerable attention, including Tyler's on both sides of the Atlantic. He begins with his observation about the unsustainability of assuming that like effects come from like causes, opting for the probability of multiple rather than singular roots. He then offers an alternative, again, the holistic and particularistic study of specific groups. We have another method, he says, which in many respects is much safer than the deductionist method he'd detailed before. A detailed study of customs in their relation to the total culture of the tribe practicing them, in connection with an investigation of their geographical distribution among neighboring tribes, afford us almost always a means of determining with considerable accuracy the historical causes that led to the formation of the customs in question. Forcing phenomena into the straitjacket of a theory is opposed to the inductive process by which the actual relations of definite phenomena may be derived. This method is much safer than the comparative method as it is usually practiced, because instead of a hypothesis on the mode of development, actual history forms the basis of our deductions. The comparative method can hope to reach the results for which it is striving only when it bases its investigations on the historical results of researches which are devoted to laying clear the complex relations of each individual culture. The solid work is still all before us. The first direct meetings between Malinowski and Boaz that have come to my attention occurred in the 1920s, when Boaz was well established at Columbia. Although Boaz had identified race as a problem rather than as a biological constant as early as his first report to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, it was not until the 1920s that the fear of race war had led various funding agencies to underwrite a significant amount of research on the subject. This is in part what turned Malinowski towards Africa as an ethnographic area, towards the problems of culture contact, and towards the challenges of what he came to call a practical anthropology. Having funded Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown to undertake this research, this is in part because Rockefeller Foundation did not like the fact that Boaz gave all sorts of money to women to do research. That's another story. The Rockefeller Foundation invited Radcliffe Brown and Malinowski separately to tour the United States. For Malinowski, this included meeting gentlemen of color in the South, visiting Indian reservations, and teaching summer school at Berkeley. It also included participating in a series of seminars held jointly with Radcliffe Brown for Boaz's students at Columbia. Radcliffe Brown would soon set himself up in opposition to the cultural school whilst at Chicago, in part, Stocking suggests, in an effort to win a larger share of funding from a limited pot by differentiating himself clearly from the culture pack. At this point, however, Malinowski still considered him an ally. I've not had the chance to research the subjects of these seminars, although I'd dearly like to know what they were talking about. Malinowski, on his travels, emphasized the importance of studying cultural processes in the present, of looking at the economic problems and legal aspects of the present blending of human strains and cultures, and that was in his report of his American tour. By this time as well, Boaz was increasingly skeptical about the possibility of establishing significant laws in the cultural realm. One could never, he felt, assume that earlier stages were necessarily simpler ones. The bias was always towards complexity. What remained in the end for him, too, was the study of process in the present. Who knows whether these interactions were at least in part influential in Boas's increasing turn away from history and towards present processes in his own work. From 1928 on, occasional letters between Malinowski and Boas show up in Boas's file of professional correspondence. The tone is mutually warm. Boas extends Malinowski an invitation to speak to his students. Malinowski responds with delight. Subsequently, reports his pleasure at a renewed friendship and being able to spend so much time with Boas when he was in New York. A few years later, on a sadder but still personal note, Boas sends his condolences to Malinowski on hearing the news of his wife's death. By far, the bulk of the correspondence, however, reveals a professional collaboration in trying to help anthropologists who have been placed at risk because of political processes, as does that correspondence between Boas and Levi-Strauss at the time. Kirchhoff refused needed visas by the colonial office to do research because of suspected communist leanings. Neumann and Lundberg ousted from Germany as undesirables. The letters reveal frustration because their own institutions have taken on as many ousted Germans as they can and at the terrifying nature of events surrounding them. In Goody's robust response to an uncritical acceptance of the stance that mid-century anthropology was simply a handmaiden of colonialism, he offers a substantial discussion of the efforts mobilized on Kirchhoff's behalf, although he hadn't seen this correspondence. The efforts that he details were mobilized by Malinowski, Audrey Richards, and others. His point was, I quote, that his case showed the political colors and the solidarity of the anthropologists of the London School of Economics. Mine would be that Boas's correspondence with Levi-Strauss, as well as with Malinowski, indicates the degree to which these efforts transcended institutional and national boundaries. Whereas Malinowski's practical anthropology of the 1920s and 30s was intended to inform policy formation, Boas's applications were an ever clearer attempt to erase racism, through both popular and academic media. He did this by trying to challenge the false science which lay at its base and by staking his claim firmly to cultural relativity. In physical anthropology, it is possible to define generalized groups. We are impressed by those forms which occur most commonly and combine these forms in one individual, the type. It is easy to show that such a type is a construct that has no reality. When a type is described, previous impressions and preconceived notions influence the descriptions of what we see. A person who has studied a Negro population will see the lips and noses of Indians as narrow, while one whose experience has been with whites will describe them as broad. It cannot be emphasized too strongly that it is a fundamental logical error to identify the construct type and the individual, to ascribe all the characteristics of the type to the individual, as well as to mistake a terminological classification for a reality. Such conclusions are scientifically unsound. What is worse, they have a disastrous effect upon our lives. It is clear that the whole Nazi anthropological theory is built up on these misconceptions. By the last decade of their lives, then, both were jointly committed to doing whatever they could to ensure that academic life was not snuffed out in the course of political events. Now, the brief story that I've told is not about the clash of titans, British Malinowskian functionalism vying for space and ultimately displacing a more archaic American historicism, although that is a story that has been constructed. The fact that academics disagree on fundamental issues about how we can know things, or even what it is worth trying to know, is not only inescapable, it's invigorating. The fact that they compete to have their voices heard, to attain stature that leads to tenure, to gain funding, is equally clear. The fact that these conflicts form the basis around which our stories are told is not to be taken for granted. Similarly, the fact that British and American anthropologists developed in distinct ways is not challenged. The ways in which this happened, however, are much more complicated and more interesting than simply due to institutional isolation. If we need culture heroes, and I'm personally not entirely sure that we do, we also need to ask why we shape their narratives in the ways in which we do. Both Boas and Malinowski recognize the potential pitfalls of colonialism. Boas coming out against the institution in 1919 through his support of the British Labour Party. And both felt, at least upon occasion, that their personal ethnographic knowledge might be used to mitigate the oppressive nature of particular instances. At the start of Boas's field work in Fort Rupert in 1886, for instance, he was grilled as to the purpose of his work and asked whether he would report the conduct of the by then illegal potlatch to the Canadian government. He subsequently made several direct interventions with the provincial government decrying the criminalization of potlatch, explaining that those who were trying to pay their debts would be punished, whereas those who were really trying to get away with something for nothing would be rewarded. Neither, however, published anything on the potentially inequitous position of ethnographers vis-a-vis the people they work with. Nor was the idea that the anthropologized might or even should enter into the process of defining the subject of study raised as an issue. Fieldwork was necessary because we, anthropologists, scientists, Westerners, somehow needed information. Yet even here, both Boas and Malinowski made contributions ahead of their time, so to speak, and in a curiously connected way. During the first decades of the 20th century, Boas became convinced that the enormous wealth of potential information to be gathered among the diverse peoples of Mexico demanded the development of an indigenous anthropology, peopled not by visiting researchers, but by Mexican anthropologists conducting their own research. To this end, Boas was instrumental in the establishment of the Instituto de Antropología in 1910, headed by Manuel Gamio, a Price student of Boas's at Columbia. Although the Institute itself did not survive the trials of the Mexican Revolution, the status of both Gamio and Antropología as a valued discipline relatively untainted by the colonialist label has continued on in Mexico well into the 20th century. Malinowski's last fieldwork was also conducted in Mexico in the summer of 1940. Although Cooper dismisses this work in a half sentence, calling it vacation fieldwork, and I'm not sure how much other kind of fieldwork happens now, Susan Drucker Brown points out several things about it that bear noting. In order to undertake the research, Malinowski entered into a formal agreement with the Instituto Indigenista Interamericano, the Inter-American Institute for the Study of Indigenous Peoples. This agreement was to accept the collaboration of Mr. Julio de la Fuente, to have a local consultative group that included Manuel Gamio, Boas's student, and the material gathered during the course of the project would be placed at the disposal of the Institute before publication. To Drucker Brown's knowledge, this is the first such agreement to be finalized in the field. It was certainly Malinowski's only real collaborative effort with a local anthropologist. Now, this final anecdote shifts the focus from the interactions anthropologists have with each other to those that occur in the field. And here again, I take my lead from comments made to me by students in the UK over the course of the last several years. On one hand, one hears the glib assertions culled from quick readings of recent reflexive anthropology. Fieldwork equals ritual, ethnography equals fiction. Both positions, as I stated earlier, framing anthropology as an egocentric experience. But even when students try to tackle the vexed question of fieldwork as a potential site of asymmetrical political relations, and to respond to calls for an engaged anthropology, and there are many, many students who take these issues very, very seriously, they tend to frame the problem in terms of what we should do. The same we, anthropologists, scientists, Westerners, as that used by Boas. Only one of my students has asked somewhat tentatively, well, who gets to decide what should be done? For the rest of this lecture, then, I shall try to consider the question of who gets to decide about fieldwork with the help of information from Inupiaq colleagues, teachers, friends, and students. What I want to do is to start by comparing the standard ethnographic bibliography in any professional anthropologist publication with the kinds of ethnographies that you find in Inupiaq households and ask if that comparison can help us think about what anthropology, ethnography, and fieldwork might be from a local perspective. But before I begin, of course, I need to give you a little ethnographic context because this is, of course, the Malinowski Lecture. As I write this, it's 11:30 p.m. The sun is still well above the horizon, obscured by a thin layer of clouds. The sky, pearl gray, hazy blue, is streaked toward the horizon with thick layers of peach fuzz cloud cover. From my window, I can see the shore fast ice, but none of the whaling crews that have gone out for the spring whaling have made camp on a spot that is visible from my vantage point. It is mid-May, the height of the spring whaling season in Barrow. Georgia Mohawk's crew got the first one of the season a few days ago. This was an important event. It's been a very difficult spring with a great deal of tragedy, a lot of deaths that have been difficult to come to terms with. For many people, the fact that this first whale gave it up so close to the edge of the ice that they didn't even have to get into a boat was a sign of great generosity and favor on the part of the whale. A sign that animal-human relations are all right in spite of the bad things that have happened. But it was so far away and the ice conditions so dangerous that it took 41 hours to get a 30-foot animal butchered and the meat brought back into town. The captain and his wife's first responsibility at this point is to host the community to a meal, for the whale gives itself to all of the community, and it must be shared with all of the community. They opened their doors yesterday at lunch and served steadily until 8 p.m. All parts of the whale, meat, muktuk, heart, tongue, kidney, and the like, are boiled and offered to all comers, followed by the very traditional bread, oranges, and tea. The meat is extraordinarily tender, and again, this is a very good sign. People come in, hug the hosts, congratulate the crew members, visit for a short while, and leave, giving thanks. Barrow, Alaska is the northernmost community on the North American continent. Situated on the coast of the Beaufort Sea and lying 400 miles north of the Arctic Circle, it has been a major permanent settlement for Inupiat Eskimos for millennia. Defining themselves predominantly as whalers, Inupiat nevertheless revel in the variety of land, air, and marine resources at their disposal, delighting in the range of tastes they bring to the table. Virtually all of the people with whom I've worked speak of their relationships with the animals as social. Animals, having intent, give themselves up to worthy recipients. That status earned through the generous sharing of hunted meat. To the general public, the North Slope of Alaska, 88,000 square miles, or approximately the top third of the state, is best known for its oil. Prudhoe Bay lies some 70 miles east of Barrow, and after 20 years of operation, continues to supply a significant proportion of American crude to Exxon, ARCO, and BP. Property taxes paid on their installations fund the bulk of North Slope Borough operations, governed by an Inupiaq North Slope Borough Assembly. This translates into jobs and services for the regional population. Today, Barrow is a city of approximately 4,000 people, and approximately half of these are Inupiaq. To run a household, one must have access to money. Oil money provides jobs, but of course also escalates the costs of living. To be fully social, one must have access to the sharing networks along which hunted food travels. The daily routine may follow a tunic, white, 9-to-5 schedule, but the annual cycle of celebrations continues to mark whaling as the major social activity bringing people together. The fights that Inupiat, as well as other Alaska Native groups, continue to fight center on issues of autonomy, who is going to exercise what kind of control over resources, social and natural, central to Inupiaq life. A brief history of Barrow ethnography. Written records detailing outsiders' observations of Barrow begin in 1852. The HMS Plover was anchored off of Barrow in the mid-19th century for 2 years as part of the search for the lost Franklin expedition. Both the ship's doctor, John Simpson, and the captain, Rochfort McGuire, left detailed diaries which have subsequently been published. John Murdoch, already mentioned, conducted his 2-year study some 30 years later. the process by which commercial whalers began to settle in the region was documented by one of them, by a participant, Charles D. Brower, who was among the first to become a permanent resident, to engage Inupiat whalers as part of his crew, to learn the language, and to marry locally. He also set up the Cape Smyth Whaling and Trading Company, and he called himself the King of the Arctic. He was the person that Tunnock visitors would come to first for any information. He published an autobiography in 1944. More interesting, probably, are the journals that are in the archives of the Fairbanks Library. The early 20th century brought traveling anthropologists, Stephenson, who romanticized the rich Arctic environment for eager urban readers, and Rasmussen, whose command of Greenlandic meant that he was able to talk to local people directly in a very short time. By the middle of the century, Robert Spencer was sent in 1950 to Barrow to study acculturation. They were doing fine, he records in his introduction, so he decided to reconstruct traditional customs using informants whose memories extend way back to the end of the 19th century. That being one of the most turbulent eras of Inupiat-Tunnock interaction, his account is not the representation of pure pre-contact social life it claims to be. Nevertheless, the North Alaska Eskimo, a study in ecology and society, has entered the ranks of classic ethnography. Norman Chance's acculturation study appeared in 1966 as the Eskimo of North Alaska. Ernest Birch, and this was one of my Bibles, conducted extensive research in the 1960s as well on changing family relations, which appear as Eskimo kinsmen. The U.S. Army sent Richard Nelson to Wainwright in the 1960s, this is a busy decade, as well to learn Inupiat cold weather survival techniques that he could then pass on to Army recruits. This turned out as Hunters of the Northern Ice, which also entered the must-read file for anthropologists. In the past two decades, publications have exploded, fueled on all sides by oil money. The local Inupiat History, Language, and Culture Commission has supported the gathering of a wide variety of materials, most notably land use inventories, elders' conferences, and a number of life histories. During the first summer of my initial fieldwork, nine other anthropologists were conducting research in Barrow simultaneously, although I was the only one to stay after September. One of my Inupiat students recalled being overwhelmed by the numbers of Euro-Americans at a recent Inuit Studies conference and underwhelmed by the content of what she heard. "Haven't they finished studying us yet?" a companion asked her ruefully. The inclusion of the above published resources would certainly be expected in any academic book about the region. A quick survey of colleagues' opinions suggests, and I agree, that any basic bibliography would need to include McGuire, Murdoch, Spencer, Birch, and perhaps Nelson or Chance. If we turn to Inupiat uses or the Inupiat ethnographies, we get a slightly different picture. Many of the households I've visited over the past decade count ethnographic works in their relatively sparse libraries. That people read and own these works is not surprising in itself. We've all heard that Fortes's work became a canonical version of how it was. We all know that Boas's work on Kwakiutl is also the canonical version of how it was. I'm not asking, though, if they read. I'm asking what they read. Murdoch's 1897 account is absolutely the hot seller, and it's come out recently in paperback, funded by the local History and Culture Commission. Beyond that, works that have been brought to my attention with approval in the last 6 months have virtually all been produced with the support of the History and Language Commission. Barrett Foote's Tigara Eskimos and Their Environment is a painstaking documentation of activities connected to the seasonal demands of subsistence hunting. It includes the most completely detailed descriptions of women's activities that I've ever seen for the region: thread making, species by species skin preparation, skin sewing in all of its manifestations, and so forth, a kind of work that I would never in my wildest imagination be able to do. Most of my Inupiat students were already familiar with the book before I began my class. The first traditional land use survey of the Colville River contains stunning portraits of elders who provide the interview texts that are contained in the volume. The book is treasured to the point of being dog-eared in many households. The diaries of Roach McGuire, already mentioned, have been read with interest. Kusik, an Eskimo life history by Waldo Bodfish, I've been told, has good stories in it, as does Puiwikat, the parallel text translation of the first elders' conference. So what are we to make of this? All of the above are accounts of detailed observations and of first-hand accounts of Inupiaq people. And here I venture onto speculative ground. Barrow Inupiat, and I don't generalize beyond that, have talked to me about two kinds of narratives. Kuliaktuat are stories of personal experience or first-hand knowledge. The assumptions that the information contained in them is true is very high. If I tell you about hunting conditions in a particular territory, for instance, listeners have the right to expect that they could act on that information. You must tell what you know. That's one of the rules, Raymond Nakhok said to me more than a decade ago. Importantly, one is making truth claims, and one is accountable for the content of those claims. Unipkat, on the other hand, are stories that have been passed on through time and are generally translated into English as legends. One should tell the story well, but one has no responsibility for the truth content of the tale. It is my sense that the ethnographies mentioned above have been categorized as kuliaktuat. The information is considered useful. The source of information is accountable for its accuracy. Now this, of course, puts rather a lot of responsibility on an ethnographer for the words that he or she commits to paper or any other medium. And this is where it becomes pretty interesting, for it seems to me that conversations I've had with a number of Inupiat offer a way for us to think about both reflexivity and engagement. Shortly after I'd begun to write up the report on my initial fieldwork, I approached Leona Okwakok, then executive liaison for the History and Culture Commission, with some anxiety. Things in Barrow were changing so fast, I felt. There were so many points of view and so many people I hadn't talked to that I felt hesitant about the accuracy of what I would be setting down on paper. She essentially and very gently pointed out that I had talked to a finite number of people over a finite period of time and that no broader claims than that needed to be made. The injunction to tell what you know is not about an absolute truth, but about truth as you know it, as you understand it. A Tehuacti, an expert reader of the ice, for instance, will tell you what he knows and will suggest that you approach other Tehuacti for further information. Truth-telling as you know it leaves room for personal experience and personal perspective, but it does not let you off the hook. Accountability, i.e., that there are such things as truth claims, that we are responsible for the accuracy of the words that we use, is central. But that takes into account the relative nature of what we can see and what we can know. When I embarked on my first formal fieldwork through the auspices of the History and Culture Commission, I was given two briefs: to provide information about families that could be used on the North Slope, and, as James Nyack said, to explain to Florida orange growers why it's so important for us to whale. It was absolutely clear to Nyack that both tasks were connected, but that the form in which they would be communicated would be different. I've not done very well with the Florida orange growers, but certainly see that as part of my job when teaching students in Britain, which, after all, is the home of the International Whaling Commission, which regulates Inupiaq whaling. This is definitely not a story of anything goes. When I first got to Barrow in 1980, the label social scientist was in bad repute. Klausner, Folks, and Moore, a sociologist, a psychiatrist, anthropologist, that's one person, and a public policy expert, had just released a study of alcohol use and abuse on the North Slope. A nationwide radio personality, Paul Harvey, had latched onto the report and announced, more or less, "You always suspected it, now you know it, all those Eskimos are all alcoholics." And it was. I mean, I heard the report. The report itself, which I just read in Fairbanks, presented a picture of a community in decline, unable to cope with rapid change and headed for a Darwinian end in which a few elite Eskimos would be able to make it and everyone else would sink into a morass of dependency and death. It's really horrific. A locally circulated critique, which was not published, pointed out that the study had been commissioned by the Public Safety Department seeking increased funding. The Public Safety Department is the police. Seeking increased funding for their preventative detention program. The sample population had been drawn from the files of persons detained for alcohol-related offenses. The interviews had been conducted with, they'd conducted through the introduction of, and in the presence of, police officers. Now, the local reaction was rage. Not that alcohol had been identified as problematic. It was, and is. But that the picture of the community itself was drawn in such a desperate and, certainly in my experience as well, inaccurate way. If I had arrived in Barrow in 1980 wanting to do anthropology rather than to work for the local tribal government, I would have been sent out on the first plane. The most frequent critique that I heard, and I've heard about other accounts of the region, was that these guys had come in for a very brief time, had not had any time to learn anything in depth, had not attended carefully, and then had gone off to pronounce as experts on things they knew very little about. Now, this has implications for the way in which the conduct of fieldwork is seen locally. I don't throw away my words for nothing, is a comment not uncommonly heard when elders are approached for interviews. This is not, as listeners might think, a demand for payment. Rather, it is a demand that the information about to be shared will be shared further. The interviewer needs to learn how to attend. Further interviewers need to show they have listened to what went on before. A great deal of the way Inupiat have talked to me about learning, in fact, sounds remarkably like extended fieldwork and participant observation. Learning by repeated practice, by watching, by listening, experimenting with different contexts, by being very patient. It emphasizes participation, as do the journal notes of a non-Inupiaq student of mine recording the preparation of a skin covering for an Umiakpiaq. The course that I'm teaching in Barrow right now is a research methods course in which the students, who are mostly Inupiaq, are designing, carrying out, and assessing projects of their own interest in connection to the practice of whaling. So this is a journal entry. When I arrived for the sewing session, I was the only observer and only knew one of the participants, Vera Williams. I thought I would be able to take a strategic post on the sidelines and merely watch and take notes on what took place. However, this attempt was short-lived. I was almost immediately asked to help. I was introduced to the group and then became one of the gophers. I helped serve beverages, assisted women in putting on protective gear in order to sew this very, very greasy skin. You get covered in plastic bin bags, and it takes quite a long time to get ready. Fetch tools that were out of reach, look for lost needles, and so on. I was encouraged to ask questions and soon was helping to replace starters and thread needles. Eventually, I tried a few simple stitches on the outside seam. The outside seam is nowhere near as crucial as the inside seam for making sure that the boat is waterproof. Although I took some notes and photos, I was mostly one of the participants in that I was given a support role in the process. This is from Tricia Hansen, and she was observing, in fact, the covering of George Amawak's boat, which was then used for catching or not catching the whale I've talked to you about. Tricia was clearly not being allowed to be standoffish. She was incorporated into the event, but as a gopher and apprentice, rather than as an outside expert. And her job in Barrow, in fact, is to run the public relations for the college. She's a professional. She was encouraged to ask questions, and she was given orders about where to go and what to do. If Malinowski had met Boaz in Barrow, neither, I venture to say, would have been accorded the big man status each had acquired in his respective original field site. Malinowski would not have had a bevy of boys to order around, as recorded in his diary. Boaz would not have been called upon to provide a feast, as recounted in an early letter. Both would have doubtless been invited to go out whaling. and put in the position of apprentices when they were sent out on the ice. Today, they would certainly be expected to present themselves to the Inupiaq Research Institute to propose their research and to provide assurances that they would incorporate local expertise on their research team, much as Malinowski did in Mexico in 1940. Both would have been respected for their attention to detail, their commitment to learning in the language. The accounts they wrote would have been read carefully and critically. The stories that I've presented put alternative glosses on how the fieldwork processes might be thought about. They are glosses that deliberately do not present models in terms of opposed boxes, but in terms of interconnected processes. It is, in fact, almost an anti-Kuhnian paradigm, models that do grow out of continuing interaction, reflexive engagement that takes responsibility for the accuracy of one's words. I'm not suggesting that every field context parallels the one that I have experienced. Different contexts make very different demands on all players, and very different things are possible. But the idea that the people in the field have a stake in the process is a constant. I would suggest that the fieldwork is ritual, ethnography is fiction stance, if accepted unthinkingly, is perhaps the easy way out for the very tough questions that have been asked by and of anthropologists over the past two decades about the fieldwork relationship. We need to think about how we think we can know things, but the we must be consciously and consistently expanded to include all of us in the research process. I would hope that the stories we teach our students lead them to assume that it's always more complicated than that, and to revel in that realization.
I'm afraid the ritual of the Malinowski lecture does not include questions, so it remains for me to thank Dr. Bodenhorn very much indeed for a characteristically lucid and elegant lecture that has raised really profound questions about the politics of anthropology, and on the way has provided, to me at any rate, some startling insights into the history of our discipline. Thank you very much indeed for a really splendid lecture. And please, what I should have said is there are drinks on the fifth floor, and we hope everybody will join us.